foes, they're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group, since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace.
That was Code Pink by Emma's Revolution. I'm Danica from Code Pink. Welcome to our radio show presented by WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and many other community radio stations like Western Mass Community Broadcasting, WMCB LP, 107.9 FM. We're also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You can check out our website at www.codepink.org/radio, where you'll find all of our episodes from episode one to our most recent. I'm super, super excited to have our two guests here today. Two awesome activists I got to meet when I was in DC a few weeks ago. Julia and Motaz, welcome to the show. Y'all are both grad students in DC, but I'll let you introduce yourself more. But I'll let the listeners know that you two have been joining us in Congress pretty much every day, you know, bird dogging politicians about their support for Israel, trying to get people not to vote for any more funding to Israel, helping get more members calling for a ceasefire. And you two have been so great, and we're very lucky to have you. But I'll let you both introduce yourselves first, maybe Motaz first and then Julia.
All right, thank you. My name is Motaz. I'm currently a doctoral student at GW University in clinical psychology. I'm Palestinian American. I currently have family in Gaza. I've unfortunately lost a lot of members to the genocide that's been going on in Gaza right now. I was just very inspired by what Medea and the rest of Code Pink was doing. I did not realize just how easy it would be to just walk in and like join the group. I found out about it sort of like late last year, but I was hesitant just out of fear and like, you know, sort of thought like there's no way you could just go in there into the Senate or whatever and like do this work. But that's literally how it works. It's been great to do the work.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Julia and I am a graduate student as well at American University. Thank you, Danica, for having me here today to talk with Code Pink. I study environmental policy and I'm finishing up my master's. Usually I'm focused on food system issues, but ever since October 7th, I mean, I was aware of what was going on to a degree between Israel and Palestine. But after October 7th, kind of watching the escalation of violence unfold so rapidly and see as well the response of my campus, which was one not of facilitating dialogue, but one of suppression, it raised a lot of red flags immediately for me. And I think in seeing the tragedies and atrocities very quickly unfold and then unfold with conversations that justified them, I became really deeply concerned. And after a few months of trying to facilitate conversations on my campus or just even have spaces to talk about why we're not getting a ceasefire or what was going on before October 7th, just trying to have conversations and seeing that consistently be repressed, I thought at a certain point I could utilize the fact that I'm a DC student and come down to Congress. And it was just, again, it was actually seeing your video, Danica, of you getting arrested that, you know, made me think that is a really, who is this person? But two, you know, how do I get involved in something like that? I'm a person who'd be willing to speak up. And yeah, like Motaz said, when I came down, I thought there would be some training, something I'd have to go through in order to participate in this, but was very quickly welcomed to just an incredible group of people and have kind of found a quick home there. So really grateful to be here with all you.
Yeah, Julie, I forgot. I was actually there on your first day, which is funny.
Yes. Yeah, you were there. That was actually too right after Aaron Bushnell, and it was the hearing that you guys got kicked out of before it even began. So right away things were action-packed.
So speaking of arrests and disruptions, you two were part of your own disruptions at this point, I think 2 weeks ago. Like, or was it last week or the week before?
Exactly a week
Okay,
from
okay.
exactly last week.
So last week, you both were able to disrupt a hearing along with a third person, I believe. So can you tell us a little bit about the hearing and what compelled you both to get up and speak, and what you said and what your experience was there?
I mean, first off, I want to mention that the other member, Yossi, was also with us, and also got arrested. And why we did it was, I mean, I'll speak for myself at least. We've been to other hearings before this one. This one was of a higher level, you could say, because it was the Senate Intelligence Committee. And the usually they'll have witnesses who like will give their input in regarding whatever the topic of the hearing is about. And this time it was like the director of the CIA, William Burns, Avril Haines, who's the director of national intelligence, was there. Biden's director of national intelligence, I forget their name, but the FBI director was there too. Like the so we had all these heads of essentially the security apparatus of the US there. And the discussion was about the quote unquote global threat to security. Which I mean, we already went in because of the hearings we'd heard in the past. We sort of knew that it was going to be let's say misaligned. That's a nice way of putting it. Because there was a lot of mention of sort of the Houthis and the Hezbollah and like all these like organizations in the Middle East that are currently like resisting what Israel is doing in Gaza. There was also talk about like how the situation in Ukraine is getting so much worse, and how, you know, the Russians are sort of like have been unchained and whatever. Lots of talk about the dangers of the Chinese and TikTok and stuff. So there was, you know, like this wide variety of issues with a lot of it focused on the Middle East, but at no point was there, I mean, they did to their very, very minor credit, they did mention that there have been over 30,000 dead, as that we know of, as part of the genocide on Gaza at the moment. But there was certainly no mention of the fact that Israel is sort of the biggest threat to global security at the moment because of their actions, as in they, for one, they are conducting a genocide that goes against any form of international law. They've committed numerous war crimes and continue to do so to this very moment. Just most recently, you know, there are reports that they arrested, kidnapped, more accurately, a bunch of people who work with Al Jazeera, just like reporting on the ground. And I mean, this is like as of a few hours ago. And there was also no mention of the fact that they are trying to escalate the war in the region, in terms of, you know, escalating things with on the South Lebanese border. They're trying to escalate. I mean, there's it's very clear, and a lot of like analysts talk about this, about like how Israel is really like this is sort of its kind of end game happening right now. Like they are trying as much as they can to escalate in the region to try and draw US troops in. And lots of like war analysts are like, this is the quickest way to a World War III that we can see. None of this was mentioned, obviously, in the in the hearing, which, you know, I say obviously, which is, it's sad, but you know, you would expect that like the heads of our security apparatus in this country would be, at least those people won't be so affected by this bias, but they very much are. And so I decided to disrupt because, I mean, I said, even as part of like, I had a sign with me that said, stop killing my people, because I myself, I'm Palestinian and I'm from Gaza. But when I got up, I made sure to say that the biggest global, the biggest threat to global security is Israel, and all these other groups that you're talking about have said that they would stop their actions if there's a permanent and lasting ceasefire and end to the occupation. So like all of these groups have made it very clear. And so I don't know, I don't remember exactly how I said it, but it was something along the lines of all of these groups, they've said that, you know, they want a permanent ceasefire and all of these hostilities would stop. So the biggest threat really is Israel for continuing their violence, their aggression that is, you know, unprecedented.
Thank you. Julia, what did you have to say when you disrupted the hearing?
Well, thank you, Taz. Like, I feel like he gave such good context for what that hearing was about and why we were really there. For me, my claim when I was in the room disrupting was to stop arming Israel, to stop sending weapons to Israel, because one of the things that has been that we continue to do, not just with our Congress, voting to send billions upon billions of dollars in military assistance, but also we had President Biden. It was released quite recently that he has approved over 100 illegal arms sales since October 7th, sending thousands of precision-grade ammunitions that are responsible for the genocide. And so those things certainly weren't going to be talked about. And I think in a hearing like this, in particular, when you are having a room full of people who I mean, I frankly believe are in the minority of individuals who are really in support of this total siege of Gaza. And we know they're going to go in there and say not just some kind of what I will say, in my opinion, is like warmongering propaganda, but also that they won't address, as Taz noted, from a humanitarian perspective as well, like the one of the biggest crises that we're facing right now, specifically for the US, as we are the ones primarily funding it. And so I think to have that voice be in the room was really important, because not only were they not going to touch on it, but I think the American public is not feeling seen, is not feeling heard, is not being represented. And to just be able to be in there, and even if we're going to be quickly pulled out and arrested for it, just to have those words present in a hearing like this, I think was really important. And then also, just given the nature of the cabinet that was there, the witnesses, it was broadcast on C-SPAN. And so there's hearings, pretty much every day in the Senate and the House. And so you could go and spend your whole life, disrupting things week after week. But this was something that I think strategically with the rest of the Code Pink team we talked about, is worth getting arrested for, is worth interrupting and having that moment to kind of share awareness. And I was just a little disappointed when I was, rewatching the clip afterwards that we weren't visible on CBS or on C-SPAN. They're very strategic about kind of putting the people who are there to observe these public hearings in the background, but nonetheless, you heard us. And even if you hear us just for 20 seconds, I think those 20 seconds really matter when we're talking about every day, hundreds, sometimes more, depending upon if there's a massacre of some sort, are dying in Gaza. And that will continue so long as our government and so long as those five people on that board continue to choose to arm Israel and not call for a ceasefire.
Yeah, and you know, if you haven't, if the listeners haven't seen it yet, there is a video of the disruptions on our social media, various accounts, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, etc. And there's just so many comments under those sorts of videos, and especially under the one that you two disrupted, where people are like, I wish I could go do this. I, you know, thank you for just like interrupting sort of the cogs in the machine that like let the war machine go forward is so impactful for people. And it just, I think it's one, cathartic for us to do, and then, you know, important for people to see. So great work to the two of you and the three of you who disrupted on that. So just to get more into the daily the congressional activities, so sometimes there's hearings weekly, but we do a lot of other stuff in Congress. But first, I want to get sort of your perspective as students. You're both in grad school. Are you all having a lot of students turn out to Congress with you? And what do you think a student's role is in this time of crisis?
I think we've had a few people join us recently. We had with us last week, I think one of the people who was with us, their name is Jacob, I believe. They are a high school student, correct me if I'm wrong. No, sorry. They're from they were they're at Rutgers, and they were spending their spring break down in DC. Just they came every day last week. So we've seen some turnout for sure of like sort of these younger people who are either an undergrad or grad students. I think on one hand, you know, that's very positive to see. Speaking for just sort of my own context, I guess, I honestly have been quite disappointed by the turnout as it pertains to like my friends or like my or like fellow students in like my program, for example. Because I mean, they all like follow me on social media, and I've talked with some of them about sort of like our need, you know, that, you know, our strength is in numbers. And a lot of people, you know, there's still sort of that almost like there's this aversion to political action that I think is born out of this privilege of not having to really pay attention to what's going on in your country, or the fact that your country is currently funding, aiding and abetting, and you know, providing diplomatic cover for a genocide that's happening in the modern day, being broadcast live. And I feel like the only reason I say that is because I don't know, to anyone who's listening to this, I would hope that they, if they feel even a little bit like maybe they are that person who's like too afraid to like speak up, or like, you know, are averse to having this like principled political position, it's, you know, I can't tell you how much we need you. We need a lot of people to be doing this. We should, in an ideal world, be, you know, hundreds of us every day in these halls of Congress, like bird dogging, running after these Congress people and senators, and going to offices and just continuously piling on the pressure. But that's not, you know, that's not the kind of turnout we've seen, and it's disappointing for sure. And you know, I try to have hope from like the ones that do show up, because there are people that come out, you know, like they spend their whole spring break. I myself spent my whole spring break going to Congress every day. That's how I celebrated. And we've seen others do that, and we've seen others join, but it's sincerely not enough. Like we need more.
I would add on to that I think, your question, Danica, about the student's role is interesting to me because I think I'm a policy student. I'm in DC. I'm also a grad student. And so in the context of my life, it makes sense, I guess, one would say to go down to Congress and to be more vocal, but certainly a lot of students are not in DC, but what I think I would echo in terms of Taz's point as well is there's so many ways to be vocal and to be involved on this. And I think one of the things that's been really disheartening for me about what's going on in Gaza right now or in the West Bank is that colleges, I feel, have played a prominent role in suppressing free speech. I think college campuses, usually their role in times of political and social upheaval, is to be the space in which there is free and critical dialogue. Or maybe this is, an ideal, this is what I had hoped they would be, and that's never been the case. But I do think this kind of suppression and the weaponization of anti-Semitism, as anything that is, anti-Zionist or is pro-Palestinian is anti-Semitic. That narrative has been prominent on college campuses. Just the general suppression of speech around this issue has been prominent on college campuses. And I think that that in some ways has stifled important dialogue and has stifled political action because normally our students are kind of our young, progressive, anti-war voter base. At the same time, I would stress that there has been great movement from the youth and like the Palestinian youth movement and the kind of resiliency of SJP groups across the country and the coalitions they've been building has been really inspiring, like despite that kind of attempt by university administrations to silence students. And so I think for those in DC, for those who have the capacity to, go to their town halls and interrupt, that student voices are really needed. But I also feel, especially for undergraduate students, because your life as an undergraduate kind of is more oriented around your campus as opposed to when you're a grad student, to really continue to push at universities. Because I think to create a culture in which we are either complacent to violence, we're indifferent to violence, we're too afraid to speak to violence, and also too afraid to speak for, basic human rights. For me, I thought I expected on my campus, one of quotes, international service, we were going to be debating like sanctions. We wouldn't be here. But again, that was kind of wishful, naive thinking. We wouldn't be here not even having the conversation in the first place. And so I think it's really important that students not only mobilize around political action and resistance on the weekends and on their spring break, but continue to try to uphold the academic integrity and humanity of their institutions on campuses, because that really, really matters. And I'm really inspired by a lot of that work being done by young people and having to do so as well. Kind of behind the scenes, hiding identities, having kind of subverted communication channels, just because it's been riskier to be vocal on this than it has with most other issues.
Thank you both. So I want to give the listeners, we post a lot on social media about what we do in Congress, but I think hearing about it from people firsthand is important too. So I want to talk about what your days in Congress typically look like, and then maybe we could just talk about some stories, things that stick with you, etc. But Taz, can you tell us, what a typical day in Congress is like, if there is one.
Sure. I think a typical day usually, we meet up at like 10 a.m. We'll sometimes meet earlier if there's like, let's say, a hearing at 10 a.m. and we, want to be there early to get in. But usually the meetup is at 10 a.m. And depending on the day, I would say like the two main things that are done is either Like Medea usually has a list of names of like representatives or senators, and whose offices that like we want to visit for the day. And so, like, for example, most recently our work has focused on targeting offices to tell them to not sign the discharge petition that would send the bill with Israel aid in it to the floor, or even going to so it was like the priority was going to offices where people haven't signed it and telling them, like, please, you know, we saw that you didn't sign it. Please continue to not sign it, essentially. Or even going to offices where maybe they have signed it, trying to get the rationale for why they did, trying to explain to them, like, you know, the danger of this petition as, you know, the main vehicle to fund, to continue funding Israel, which is conducting a genocide. And so some days look like that, where we go to offices, talk to sort of, I mean, we literally just walk in. Usually there's like interns working in the front desk, and we just kind of like ask them to that we want to speak with whatever high-level staffer is currently available in the office, you know, ideally chief of staff. I mean, most ideally, like, they're in very rare occasions the actual like congressman or congresswoman would come out. But you know, most of the time it'll be like chief of staff or some like foreign affairs specialist or some legislative specialist as a, who's part of the staff. And we'll sort of like talk to them, try to get their rationale, try to convince them, relay our stories. I usually relay my story and try to like give them a more humanized sort of view of like what's going on the ground. The other thing that we do is we go to a lot of hearings. So some hearings will be more like the one we disrupted was something that was, you know, related to what's going on in Palestine. But there are times where we'll even go to hearings that have little to nothing to do with it. And the and those days we do that such that we can bird dog those politicians later, because those hearings are the biggest opportunity. Like they're the main times where like you will have this sort of congregation of several representatives all together, and we will wait for them outside. And as soon as we spot one with the little like pin, we will follow them and ask them about like why haven't they called for a ceasefire? Are they aware of what's happening in Gaza? Are they willing to like reconsider sending money to Israel, things of that sort. I would say those are the two main things that happen. But every now and then, I mean, there's it's whatever the day throws at you too. Like sometimes there are hearings that we find out about like the day before. There are some days like the like last Monday where, you know, the whole plan was a disruption. There are some days I won't say too much about it, but like there's like a sort of a different plan for tomorrow, which actually this comes out later. So, but anyways, like there's it's usually like those two, like it's either visiting offices or planning some bird dogging, but sometimes it's sort of whatever opportunity throws is thrown your way of like causing some disruption or some bigger action within Congress to really make ourselves heard and make it clear like what we're asking for.
Yeah, Congress was such a whirlwind that, 'cause I was only there for a week, but it was like every day there was something. I felt like a spy. I was like, 'cause we were the week I was there, we were trying to figure out what the discharge petition even was. And so we spent like a whole day on that. So it's definitely such it's so different every day.
Thank you to Julian Maltaz for joining us for the first part of the show. We'll be right back with the two of them to continue our conversation. You're listening to Code Pink Radio, coming to you through Pacifica Radio's WPFW in Washington, D.C., WBAI in New York City, KPFT in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. We'll be right back after this break with Montaz and Julia.
Both our eyes are red, but you're high and I'm crying. You're trying to forget, but it hits me every time. You pray next to me, your right hand holds your left sleeve, turning our heads gently, cause when it ends we fight. And in that warm winter I withered, I just wanna get better. I'll be what you like, and every letter of fire you read me when I'm tired makes me wanna cry. Whose Lord are you naming when you start to break things? It's my only life you hold. And when you left me waiting, I thought, did you do it in the name of God?
And that was Name of God by Mustafa the Poet. And we're back with Julian Motaz to talk about Code Pink being in Congress every single day. You are listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
So do you guys think it's been effective? Have there been members of Congress that have changed their minds, or do people you talk to seem movable at any point? Like, how's the trajectory been?
That's a great question. So in if we had like many hours, I would go on a spiel about like the philosophy of activism and if like, is it effective or not? Is that relevant to doing activism? But I will spare you all of that with a more concrete answer. I think we have certainly been effective in some cases. I think, you know, going into it and being realistic with, I'll speak for myself. I don't want to assume for others, but myself, you know, I tend to have a more cynical view of our politicians. So I didn't go in with the expectation that like, and I mean, this is also sort of influenced by my, you know, background in psychology. Like you never have like one therapy session with a patient and like all of a sudden they're like, oh, I'm cured. Like, thank you. it takes a lot of work and a lot of time. In terms of like, do I think that there are situations where staffers have certainly heard us? I would say for sure. I can think of one recent example where I felt like I can't remember her name, but it's a congresswoman from Alaska who herself like hasn't even called for a ceasefire, which is very disappointing. But one of her staffers spoke with me at length after, like, so we like gave our spiel to, I think, her chief of staff, who was like not that nice, and definitely was one of those people who just have those like glazed eyes. You're like speaking to them from the heart and like you can tell nothing is registering. But then this other person, this other staffer in her office, someone who told me that they are there sort of on this fellowship as part of the office, and they work with like indigenous and tribal rights. And so that's someone who I like talked to more at length and felt like they were definitely affected by it. Like they definitely were listening and being moved by what they were hearing. Whether that translates to, you know, them, like, I can't speak to, I would hope that they go to the congresswoman, you know, at some point, whenever the next meeting they have, and like, they really like stand their ground and tell the congresswoman like, hey, you need to call for a permanent ceasefire. Like, this is insanity. Is that what's happening? I don't know. I would, the optimistic part of me would hope that that's happening in some places. I think another example I can think of that's like a more concrete one, would be when like we had a meeting with Senator Van Hollen's people. So it was like his chief of staff, is it like all the higher level staffers in his office. And we were very candid with them, actually. Julia like got up at some point and said some very, very powerful and moving words, essentially like breaking the fourth wall, so to speak, like, because it was, all of us were talking in this very, quote unquote political sort of like professional way, and she just kind of like broke that and said like, the guys, like, this, like, people are dying, and there's enough of this like political calculation, like there are people dying on the ground, it's a genocide, we need, like, you guys need to wake up to this. And we were very, very honest, and it was a very powerful meeting. And I mean, I remember shaking their hands on the way out and like looking them in the eye and saying like, please, like, you're in a position where you can do something, like, please do something about this. And I could tell, and that's one thing that I guess my radar for these things has gotten better with the more experience I've had doing it, but I could tell that they really, really, like, it got in their mind somewhere, like that, like something was implanted there. And I mean, since then we've seen like part of what we did, we talked about then, was how we were disappointed with Van Hollen as someone who's like actually been very outspoken about, what's going on in Gaza, in a way where it's like criticizing the Israeli government and the Israeli actions. But then he went and voted for the bill sending more money to Israel regardless. And since then we've seen more and more, like he, I think, was on CBS last night even, talking about like being very, very openly critical about Israel, saying that all these claims about UNRWA are entirely false, like we need to resume funding to them. So putting the dots together, I would hope that like that meeting, as well as meeting with others who have advocated for Palestine, like have sort of actually impacted the staffers, which then impacted the senator to, dig, like dig his heels in further into like criticizing the Israeli government. So those are, I guess, some concrete examples to give you. More than anything, too, I find a lot of hope in terms of like, is our work effective, in terms of the sort of low-level staffers that we see in the offices, like those interns in the front desk. Because we've seen a lot of cases where, I mean, I can, this is almost the case in almost every office we go to, or I guess the majority of them, where I'll be talking to the chief of staff or what have you, all everyone will be talking to them, and from the corner of my eye I see the intern like at the desk, like very actively engaged in listening to what we're saying and like nodding at points, and very just sort of these like subconscious cues of like sort of in showing agreement in this sort of weird, like, very subtle way, which they can't explicitly say, obviously, because they are, employed by the government and by the whatever the rep whoever the representative is. And so I think there is some real effectiveness there of like we're implanting these seeds in what is hopefully the next generation of staffers and what have you, or potentially even representatives who have had to hear us talk and talk and talk and have like their eyes opened up to what the reality is in Gaza. But it's, that's a slow burn. Wish it could be faster. And the last point I'll make is, in the worst case scenario, like in the case of Representative Chuck Fleischmann, our dear friend, it's a bit sarcastic, by the way, we expose them. Like if they are particularly unhinged in their beliefs, or they have some really, really hateful, disgusting ideology, worst case scenario, it's like, we are going to show your true face to the American public, as we did with Chuck Fleischman, as we did with God knows how many. There's so many of them now that we've exposed. So yeah, it is effective for sure in that sense, in a different sense when it comes to those cases.
Just in case listeners haven't seen the video of your interaction with Chuck Fleischman, can you describe what happened really quick?
So we were doing bird dogging, which, we just like run after these congressmen, congresswomen in the halls, and like I think I described it earlier, just we sort of asked them, why haven't they called for a ceasefire, or do they know what's happening in Gaza? Anyways, this it was honestly really, really strange and really like at no point would I have predicted to you that this is a reaction that I would receive or any of us would receive. But this congressman was especially elevated, went on this tangent. You really should watch the video to anyone listening. It's surreal that this is an elected representative of our Congress. But they pretty much, they're waving their hands around like, I will always support Israel. I will never waver in my support to Israel. God is with Israel. And then he says, "I will. You can tell the Palestinians that I will never support them." At which point I said, "I'm a Palestinian. You can say it to my face." And then he stops and says, "I will say to your face, goodbye to Palestine." And then goes on to say a bunch more like, Israel will never fall, I will always be with Israel, blah, 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 until he like escaped in the elevator, which is usually how they one of the ways they dodge us is they go into the members only elevator, which we aren't allowed to go into. And yeah, it was I really like I've struggled to like process that moment since, because on one hand it's this, obviously very horrible, abhorrent thing to say and think to even believe. I mean, he literally just said like goodbye to Palestine, in implying, not even really implying, just sort of directly saying like, you guys could be wiped off the map, and I will be happy with this. Just straight up genocidal intent. But on the other hand, too, part of me in that moment admittedly got like a little bit giddy, because I was like really, really happy that he said it out loud. Because the real kicker in all of this is Mr. Chuck didn't like, it's not like what he's saying is a controversial opinion in Congress. He just said it out loud in a way that others have been trained not to. And even when like I saw him again the next day and talked to him, I'm like, can we continue our conversation? And it was clear that his PR people had sat him down and said like that, like you can't go around saying this stuff. To like when I asked him like, what about like Palestinians, and he said like, I love everyone. It's like, okay.
God.
But the reality is, I mean, I won't even I'll use like I will say that at least half of the House of Representatives agrees with his view, and what I use for that number, just so like I don't throw out just arbitrary number of like my feeling, I think it was over like 150 or 160 members of the House who condemned the ICJ's decision to even hear South Africa's point, to even like the fact that the ICJ even like accepted South Africa's proposals, that like they wanted to go to the ICJ and show that the Israeli state is genocidal. Over 150 members of the House came out condemning South Africa for even suggesting this, which
Yeah.
tells you that almost half of the people, this is what they agree with. Like they won't even consider the fact that like they would consider any even declaration that this is genocide is anti-Semitic or what have you. Which for me, it's like these people agree with what Chuck Fleischmann said, let alone the fact that he has received, as far as I'm aware, zero disciplinary repercussions for
Yeah.
this straight up genocidal intent. So.
We're sort of running out of time here, but I think you did a good job illustrating how I don't even know what the word is, 'cause for me it's not demoralizing. I wasn't feeling demoralized while I was in DC in Congress, but I was feeling something negative. I can't put the word to it. Depressed maybe is a good word. Disappointed maybe. But it's never shocking, which is upsetting in itself. So, Julie, I'm wondering, maybe we could wrap up here, but if there are any moments in Congress that stick out to you where you've felt some sort of hope for the future?
Yeah, thank you. I would say there's so many hard conversations, and there's a lot of times I come home and I feel kind of wounded. My soul has kind of taken a beating that day. And then at the same time, one, I would say I find hope in the fact that our voice is there, because if this is so prevalent, how much worse would it be if they could go the whole day and just hear things that were reinforcing these ideologies? Like, the fact that we can be there in that office and offer what I would consider a voice of reason, one, gives me hope, and I think makes it worthwhile. And also, again, speaking on behalf of the voter base, I mean, at least, because a lot of times we're targeting Democrats and progressives, and we know statistically, like, 80% of Democrats are calling for ceasefire, and yet we're not seeing that in our representatives. And so I feel like we then become a voice that they are ignoring, probably because of PAC interests a lot of the times in the case of our quote progressives. But I also do see hearts and minds changing. We have moments, even if they're really frustrating, like with Jen Schakowsky, where like she is so in favor of sending money to Israel, but when we're trying to have the conversation about how undemocratic it is to be, putting all of these military aid bill military aid supplementals together, or how, no matter how it's packaged, even if there's quote humanitarian aid next to bombs, that that's illogical, and we don't want, we do not want to see our representatives sending any more weapons to Israel, even if they think they're sending humanitarian aid, which, so many people, we can debunk that from several different angles. But what is clear sometimes is that I don't know if they're, even registering that argument. Sometimes I wonder if they're just getting their, political points across, that they're not hearing the rebuttals. And so that's reinforcing. And just even in terms of thinking of example, like last week, after Jim McGovern, who is usually such a progressive, put this discharge petition on the floor, we went into his office and we actually ran into him, which was, fortunate. But then we had this kind of 30-minute conversation with him, which again was really frustrating, because it almost feels like, we just file through all of these different political explanations for why we are going to potentially vote on a bill that would send an additional $14 billion to Israel in the midst of a genocide, breaking our own domestic laws, breaking international humanitarian law, also just unconscionable. But then you see the next day, after that long conversation, after some of our women, like Martha, got emotional, and was there and just conveying this very human aspect of, like, you're not just, spending taxpayer dollars in ways we don't want. You're not just breaking laws. You are committing the worst, like a crime against humanity, and you're complicit in it, and you're breaking our hearts for doing so. And the next day he came out with a tweet, and I'm not going to say, we have no means to, control for this variable and say that because we spoke to Jim McGovern the next day, he's going to tweet, Biden, no more weapons to Israel. However, I would say that we definitely spent a good amount of time with this man and really conveyed that we were so disappointed. And to have him come around the next day and kind of push for this no more weapons to Israel agenda was heartening. You know, it was something that I went, I think that we had some influence. And even if we didn't, even if it was because he went home and heard it from his kid or who knows, to just have to have made that point and to have pushed back against his action of putting a discharge petition. And I have tried to, in recent weeks, kind of turning off the camera for some of the interactions with Congress people that I am recognizing, and just trying to have conversations where I'm trying to get more of a grasp of their rationale behind continuing to fund a genocide. And there are moments where you get these human interactions and you kind of hear them acknowledge the crisis that's going on and that people are not buying the kind of I don't want to say, you know, a profane word, but the sham, the lies, the stuff that they like to feed us. Johanna Hayes, for instance, last week I ran into her and I got emotional because she had again voted on the discharge petition and said, well, you know, because of Ukraine, I have to send money to Israel. And I just kind of looked at her and I was like, what is it going to take? I need to understand what is it, what's it going to take for you guys to draw a line? How many people have to die? How many people have to be starving? Because I just don't understand this. I don't understand where the red line is. Clearly, Biden doesn't have a red line. Like, what is Congress's red line? And I think that bothered her. And so, yeah, I think we do make an impact. And whether or not we see immediate results, I find a lot of hope in the fact that we're there every day and we get to speak for a lot of people. And we get to speak for humanity. It would make me more sad to think Congress was just an echo chamber of PAC interests and Zionist propaganda. I am not comfortable with that.
Well, thank you both, and thank you.
I, if it's okay, I will just reiterate Julia's last point, honestly, about even if we're not gonna move how the ruling class thinks, but someone's gotta do it. I would rather, and I think most people listening would rather live in a world where we are there putting some pressure on, as opposed to there is a world where if we're not there in Congress, Congress is just what it is every day, and people never have to hear this. So
Yeah.
I'm glad that we do what we do.
And I'm, so grateful for you too and for the work that y'all are doing every day and the time you're putting in. And I feel a lot of gratitude for being able to meet you. I wish in a different lifetime it was under different circumstances, of course. But I think you all gave a really good illustration of what we're doing in Congress. And I will say that if you're in the DC area, you could join us any day, Monday through Friday. And thank you for listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink till hunger. Trained him to be a man when our enemy was not Iraq but Iran.
They